welcome to Book Talk from Scottish Book Trust. I'm Paul Gallagher, and I'm joined this month by two distinguished guests, Phil Miller, arts correspondent for The Herald, and Claire Stewart, reader development coordinator for Scottish Book Trust. We'll get into our discussion of this month's featured book momentarily, but before we do that, let me remind you that the best way to ensure you never miss an episode of Book Talk is to subscribe through the iTunes store. Just search for Book Talk in iTunes and you'll find our page under podcasts. We've also very excitingly just introduced Bookmarked, a second monthly podcast in which host Ryan Van Winkle reports on all the latest goings-on in the world of books and Scottish Book Trust with interviews, festival coverage, book lists, and much more. With the addition of Bookmarked, you'll now get something new from us to listen to every 2 weeks. So now we turn to this month's featured book, and undoubtedly the most anticipated publishing event of this year, The Casual Vacancy, the first book for adults by J.K. Rowling, author of the phenomenally successful Harry Potter series. Published at the end of September, amidst a burst of interviews and TV appearances from the generally publicity-shy author, The Casual Vacancy achieved massive first-week sales and received very mixed immediate reviews from critics and readers alike, with some unable to resist claiming Rowling's spell has been broken, while others praised her decision to tell a story of painful reality as opposed to Potter's magical fantasy. Unlike the ever-expanding world she created for the Harry Potter books, in The Casual Vacancy, Rowling limits herself to one small location, the seemingly idyllic West Country village of Pagford. The story begins with a death. Local councillor Barry Fairbrother dies suddenly, and as well as leaving a huge hole in the lives of his widow, Mary, and their children, his death creates an empty seat in Pagford Parish Council. That's the casual vacancy. We soon learn that Barry was a key player in an argument that had been brewing in the council for some time, about whether Pagford should redefine its boundaries in order to separate itself from the Fields, a run-down council estate and the location of a contentious drug rehabilitation centre that Pagford unwillingly inherited many years previously. As Rowling's big, leisurely narrative slowly unfolds, we meet the many and various characters surrounding this central issue. On the side wishing to rid Pagford of the blight of the Fields is Howard Mollison, the gigantic patriarch who heads up the council and hides a fiendish plotting mind behind his genial exterior. His gossip-hungry wife, Shirley, their son and presumed heir, Miles, and his increasingly frustrated wife, Samantha. On the other side, attempting to fill Barry's shoes in making a case for the inclusion of the Fields as part of Pagford, is Colin Cubby Wall, the local high school's deeply insecure assistant head. His wife, Tessa, the school guidance teacher, and Pagford's GP, Parminder Jawanda, whose five family members constitute the total number of non-white faces in Pagford. Alongside this principal cast of characters, and arguably where the novel's lifeblood lies, is a collection of Pagford's teenagers, who are by turns frustrated, disillusioned, and generally abused by life and, in one case, their parents. With Fields resident and high school cautionary tale, Crystal Whedon, the most significant in terms of the destination that Rowling's huge plot ultimately reaches. I could go on, as there are many more significant characters in this story, but I want to get to my guests, Phil Miller from The Herald and Claire Stewart from Scottish Book Trust, and find out what they made of all this. One word of warning, we're anticipating that if you're listening to this, then you will have read the book, so we will be going into some plot details, although we won't give away the ending. So, Phil, we asked you to read this book in order to come on the Book Talk podcast and discuss it. Are you glad you've now read it?
I don't think I ever regret reading a book, but I found it quite grueling. You know, I found it quite hard to read. The ending is a very sad ending. I think once you've read the ending, my view of the whole book has changed slightly. And the fate of one of the main characters that you mentioned, a deeply sad, quite a very moving ending, has made me rethink the book. But the actual process of reading 2/3 of the book, or even 7/8 of the book, I found quite difficult.
So what was it? Can you pin down particularities that made it not an enjoyable experience?
I mean, there's a cast of, many characters. That's not necessarily a bad thing in a novel. We've seen it in many other novels, of course. But I felt that there, so many of them were cardboard characters. We're told what they're doing and what they're thinking. And most importantly, we're told what to feel about them, really. Mm. You know, we don't like most of the characters. They're complacent, hypocritical, they're nasty, they've got bad habits. There's a couple of characters that we are told to like a lot, Parminder, Jawanda, and his family. Crystal Whedon, the unfortunate girl at the centre of the novel's kind of real emotional heart, I think. Mm-hmm. And a couple of other characters, but mostly they're kind of unpleasant, small town, not very nice people. And the town itself didn't feel real to me. I mean, I grew up in a small market town, not in the West Country, but in the north of England. Yeah, it's full of people who are scheming against each other, and there's lots of small-minded bigotry. But you get them in, that in cities, but it's kind of a different kind of atmosphere. But it didn't feel like a regular town to me. It's weird, there's no shops. She doesn't spend a lot of time describing things, you know, and I'm not expecting Thomas Hardy, but, you know, I didn't get a real feel of the town at all. I think it could have been a more rich novel, and the themes that she's tackling, and oh my God, how many themes are there? A lot of things that are wrong with modern society are in there, and especially with the young, and you can feel the empathy for the young characters. Mm-hmm. Self-harm, self-disgust, and all the problems that come with being a teenager, and all the problems of being a teenager. And I know Joanne Rowling herself hated being a teenager. She's talked about it before. It's a horrible period of her life.
It's interesting that having moved from being a writer for young people to writer for adults, that it's still in the realm of young people that her characters really come to life. Yes. And I agree with you on that point. But before we talk more about that, I want to come to Claire. And, you know, Phil's obviously given quite a, not wholly negative, because you said the end gave you a slightly different light, but certainly not a hugely positive take on the book. What was your response to him?
I really enjoyed reading it a lot. And it, in fact, when I started reading it, I was on a bit of a deadline because I had to give the book to somebody else. I actually didn't want to rush it because I was enjoying it so much. I didn't want to have to speed through it to get to the end. I thought it wasn't perfect. There was a lot of things that I think could have been written better, but ultimately, I thought it was the way that she portrayed people's inner lives that I really enjoyed. It quite searingly honest in parts. You know, you think, for example, one Fats who just is just like unbelievably eye-wateringly arrogant. Like he just, but I can kind of remember having those kind of thoughts as a teenager. Got to be authentic.
That authenticity thing, I found that really interesting and compelling. Like, I'm not saying admirable, but I agree with you, that kind of honesty and that ability that she has to kind of evoke his inner life, Fats in particular, and several other characters, but his in particular is hugely compelling, and I found it really believable.
That's quite a shocking storyline too, which I'm not going to spoil endings for people, but
she writes well about certain characteristics of all these people, but I'm not sure it can be in every single character that they're all these kind of, everything is kind of heightened and emphasised. It didn't feel real to me, and I don't know whether she was going for reality. I don't know whether she wanted it to be a piece of realism as such, you know, that these were people you could meet easily and you recognised instantly. You recognise their characteristics, but you don't recognise them as real people.
Like you say, there was that sort of heightened thing, and also, Phil, you were saying about how it wasn't realistic as a small town, that you didn't have enough description. I don't know if that was a... I don't think that was a flaw to me in the book, because it was all based in people's inner lives. You know, everybody in this book, you get a glimpse into most of these main characters' inner lives. The drama of the events in their lives to them is huge, and then it switches to a different perspective, and actually what's happened is not that big a deal, but it's the sort of melodrama that
I kind of developed a theory on the train over here from Glasgow, because we're in Edinburgh at the moment, and although it sounds a very strange comparison, when I first read American Psycho, I was completely bewildered by it and just thought, why would you write a whole novel about it, you know, about a serial killer? Then I realised it's actually a massive critique of capitalism and consumerism. And I was wondering whether the whole book is a metaphor or a big kind of theatrical tableau, where this book isn't really about Pagford or anything, it's about Middle England, and it's about all the things she dislikes. She grew up in the West Country at a town I know a little bit called Yate in the West Country, and I wonder whether the whole book is really about that. You know, certain newspapers pander to that, these Middle England kind of attitudes, small-mindedness, the derision towards people who are poor, the way people treat outsiders, you know, amplified in the estate they're all trying to get rid of. So I wonder whether the book's about that really, rather than this place in particular.
I think you could legitimately read that into it. I mean, it's definitely...
And also, although they live in the West Country, they all seem to talk in Cockney, which is like very strange.
That's an interesting point. I couldn't quite get a handle on what kind of voices she was wanting me to imagine.
I was reading,
because there's a lot of abbreviation and loads of apostrophes and letters missing out words, but you can't. It doesn't actually clearly convey to you what accent it is, and I think that is a bit of a problem, because you're just reading it as random, like Cockney, yeah, you're just going to the, but that doesn't really make sense.
Yeah, I did have a sort of West Country slash Devonshire accent in my head, but that wasn't because of the way it was written, that was just my imagination filled that in for me.
I think she goes into great detail about what the middle class characters are thinking and their views on life, because we're meant, because I think we're not meant to agree with them at all, or a lot of the time we're not agreeing with them, or they're being put out there to be analysed and rejected by the reader. And I think that's why she goes, we're not meant to like them, and whereas we're meant to have instant sympathy for the poorer and more unfortunate characters. Whereas I think that's as a novelist, I know it's a personal thing, but I think rather than telling people, you should show rather than tell. Yeah. And this is what I felt all the way through, that she was telling me all the way through, where rather than just showing me what people did.
Yeah, and also that in terms of her style, like one of the things that she does throughout the novel is use brackets to parenthesize like kind of flashbacks of history, or also what happened earlier that day and that kind of thing. I mean, how did you guys feel about the use of Phil, you're shaking your head, you were not really into it.
No, I didn't, especially I don't mind brackets, but when the bracket goes on for, you know, a page, 2 pages, yeah. I think, am I still in the bracket kind of thing. As far as the style, I mean, the first 20 pages I found really difficult. The amount of toasters, dishwashing machines, washing... I mean, it was really kind of almost fetishistic, kind of, this is what people have in their kitchens. It was like falling asleep in John Lewis or something. You're just dreaming about all these accoutrements that people have in their middle-class houses. And it's mentioned all the way through, toasters. She's obviously got a thing about it. And then, of course, when we get to the fields, the houses have nothing in them at all. Yeah. Maybe that's the point she's trying to make. But
do you feel like at all that there's an element... You know what you were saying just earlier about readers naturally kind of sympathizing with the poor people and rejecting the ideas of the middle class people. But I guess thinking about J.K. Rowling's audience and the breadth of people, you know, there might be people who don't buy many books or read many books, but they'll probably buy the new J.K. Rowling one. Is she in any way aiming at her audience as well? You know, like kind of saying, look at yourself. You are horrible.
I know, she could be, you know, it could be a device to sort of lure in her usual readers and then go, aha, this is what you think. You're shallow and materialistic and casually racist and all the other things that she accuses the middle class characters, the Middle England characters, let's call them, in the book of being. I mean, maybe that's it. Maybe she was doing that on purpose. I don't know.
It's a political book. There's no doubt about it. I mean, big P and small P. You know, she has opinions on all these social issues, and oh my God, there's so many social issues. There's almost one a page. Her personal views come through, which obviously kind of left of centre, I guess you'd call Labour. Views on all these things, and it's definitely a political book. I saw one of the reviews said it was a socialist tract, which is, I mean, she's almost a billionaire in dollars, I think, so it would be strange, but Engels was a rich guy as well, but I'm not sure it's quite that, but she's definitely pointing to fractures in society, and I think in a really quite heavy-handed way. But then I guess you could say Charles Dickens did the same.
Yeah, and I think, as you said right at the start, I think in conclusion it's heavy-handed, but the book, the finale, packs a real punch, and it does kind of leave you distressed. And in that way, it works, because it's taken these characters who you have begun to care about to an awful place, and it leaves you deeply sad and with nothing but to reflect on the issues that she has raised. So it's working.
Quite a despairing ending, isn't it?
It was bleak. I put the book down and just kind of stared into space for about half an hour, thinking, what is there to live for, really? But that was mainly because I'd finished a really good book and I didn't know what to read next. No, I wasn't expecting it. I don't know about you. When you're reading it, not only the actual event of the ending, I suppose, but also the effect that it had on some of the characters, because some of the characters came out of the other side at the end, a completely different situation than they'd been through the book. So it was like a sort of transformative event at the end.
Yeah. I think it needed to be, because otherwise I was reading it thinking, are any of these characters going to change? And it seemed to me throughout the novel that the only characters who were even going to be allowed to change were the teenagers, and the adults were going to be like fixed forever. But actually there is this kind of catastrophic, not just one event, but series of events which forces certain characters to change. But it put me in mind of, as I got to the end, I thought, ah, she's trying to do like... you mentioned Thomas Hardy, or one of those great sort of Victorian novels that builds to a kind of unrealistic, almost sort of crescendo drama.
Tragedy.
Yeah, and that, like where all the characters are thrown completely out of the path that they were on. And in that way, it sort of made sense and made me see the sort of fullness of her ambition, if you like, if she's trying to, if she's really trying to do that kind of novel. I don't think she's a good enough writer of words, if you like. I think she's a great writer of stories, but she's not a great linguist.
There's no beautiful passages of writing in the book.
Yeah, you're right.
But she does, I mean, as you say, she does kind of explain what characters are thinking very clearly. It's almost like a kind of, in note form, you know, what this right. character's thinking, what this character's thinking. But as literary experience, he said, it's not I enjoyable, but as you're right, the story does carry you along. Yeah.
She's very witty as well. Like, there's some sentences in it that I just thought, well, it's not, like, it's not, like you say, it's not about the language, but the wit was just, like, so sharp, and sometimes really unexpected too, which made it quite a dark book, like, sort of blackly humorous in a lot of places. She'll be discussing something really quite, really quite grim, and then suddenly she'll just throw in some sharp little aside, and they're usually social observations of people's behaviour or thoughts. And so in that way it's been compared a lot to Austen as a form, you know, in the form that it's in, or you know, the Middlemarch comparisons. Yeah.
Muggle March.
Because she does have a bit of a talent for that, I think, and she, you know, she did it in the Harry Potter books as well, of certain social behaviours and types of views on it. But she's very witty. Hit a lot of caricatures right on the nose as well. But then that also made the tragic bits even more shocking. I don't know about either of you, but there was some of the scenes in it where I almost had to put the book down and stop reading, because I was like, well, this is really upsetting.
There's a rape scene, isn't there?
Yeah.
Which is actually quite sparely written.
Yeah.
You know, it's only like a couple of paragraphs, really.
Yeah. It wasn't gratuitous.
No.
If it had been gratuitous, then that would
come. And it is really a strong, that is a really strong piece of writing, and it jumps out of the novel, because I think she's obviously agonised, spent a lot of time writing that scene to get it right, you know. And that is a powerful part of the novel, and I just wish that kind of quality of that intensity she gets in that scene and the final pages, the final, you know, 30-40 pages had been from the start, because if it wasn't by J.K. Rowling and I picked it up in a bookshop, I wouldn't have got beyond the, you know, the toasters and the dishwashers and the first 20 pages. I just wouldn't. It didn't grab me straight away.
No, that's true. It didn't grab me either. But I think in a way, it's a bit difficult to kind of imagine that scenario where this book has been written by another writer, because she does take advantage, if you like, of her position and know that readers will go with her, so she can take that time. It's not like the first Harry Potter book, where it's short and it's punchy and it's concise and you dive straight in because you have to grab the attention. So in a way, like, I know what you're saying, but that's a situation which we can't really judge it on. But to come back to the moments of, you're absolutely right that rape scene, the sort of spare way which is written, incredibly powerful, and also the aftermath where he's gone and she's just there, and that takes longer. There's more time taken over what she's feeling and thinking, and it makes you really think about what's just happened and the situation that she's in right now, and it's awful, but it's very moving. But another scene which I think is equally powerful, and I think it's in these moments of kind of intensity that she really does kind of hone her writing down, the scene where Simon Price really lets rip in violence on his family. That was one of those moments where I almost couldn't read on, because it was so brutal and matter of fact as well. Like, and this character seems to have no qualms about using the most vile language and the most horrific violence against his own family. I mean, I couldn't understand it, you know, but I was in the moment, and that's powerful stuff.
The thing that interested me as well about this novel was that part of the storyline with Simon Price and Andrew Price. Why were there really, like, all the other sort of strands of the novel where people were having problems or things were going on in their lives, somehow were resolved by the end, except for theirs, except for Andrew's, you know, because he has this abusive father who's violent towards him and his mother and his brother, and he's kind of, you know, desperate to do anything that he can to stop it from getting worse. Is there some sort of message behind that, or was it just on, like, was it just carelessness on her part? Like, was she trying to say something by not making that resolve? Was it like, well, this is just one of these things that goes on and
bad
it just keeps
happen.
Going on?
Mm.
Or was she trying to say, well, Andrew's all right because his parents are middle class, so ultimately he still has a roof over his head? Or, do you know, what did you think about that? I mean, did you...
Yeah, I was so wishing for Andrew to pick up something heavy and hit his father, you know, do you know what I mean? In that scene, you're right, but it is a strong scene, although I thought almost too heightened, you know, it is a strong scene, but there was something almost unreal about it. But then, it was kind of almost told from Andrew's perspective, wasn't it? So I guess it did feel kind of unreal that these things were happening. I don't think there is a message there. Maybe it's more of a existential kind of thing that, you know, bad people do bad things to nice people, and they carry on until someone, you know, calls them on it or they get done for it, you know. And maybe, you know, she deliberately left it without resolution. I felt so sorry for him. But yeah, I thought he was gonna do away with his father at some point, but he never did.
Well, there were so many threats as well, like in the novel, like there were so many sort of objects that had a sort of threatening energy about them. Like, she would mention things like
the poker,
the EpiPen, the bicycle as well. I was sure that something was going to happen with his father's bicycle.
Yes, you're right. I think these things were kind of glowing, kind of throbbing with power, but they were never used against him. The dialogue, some of it isn't good or right, you know, and it doesn't read right, and we've talked about how she writes the dialect, and I don't think it quite works.
Yeah.
I'm not sure there was any need to put in the dialect in a way. It's kind of like working class people speak funny, kind of slight, kind of reverse snobbery or something there. I don't know. Simon Price is, I mean, he calls his son Pizza Face once, but he calls him about 40 times, and it doesn't sound right. It didn't sound real.
It didn't bother me, like, and I can see that, like, this was a... But as I read it, I wasn't thinking, oh man, the dialogue. Apart from the dialect that we really talked about, that was the only time that it really tripped me up and was like, I had to reread things. So it's like, what's she saying? How is that? Yeah, exactly. But no, it wasn't so much of an issue for me. Like,
I have to say, I didn't really notice it, and it didn't really stand out as anything, one or the other, bad or good. And also, I did just imagine a West Country accent. Whether that was actually in the dialect or not, I couldn't have told you.
But something about style and language that I did want to sort of raise with you guys is particularly the beginning of the book, the first while, it really felt to me like she was trying to cram in as much adult content as possible. Like, there's so much swearing and, like, scenes of sex and just general kind of stuff that you don't put in books for kids. I guess maybe it's because of who the author is. It felt a little forced to me to start with, of like, I'm doing this on purpose because I'm writing a book for adults. As I read on, it didn't feel like that anymore, but it, like, because it felt more kind of consistent, I guess. Yeah. I don't know if you guys...
But people do swear. I mean, grown-ups swear.
Yeah.
So
it's not like... I'm not saying it's gratuitous and I was like, oh, this is disgusting, I can't... It's more... It just felt like it was really sort of foregrounded as like, oh, here's a really grubby sex scene on page 5, you know, like, type thing. Like, wow, check out me writing for adults, you know, like, that kind of thing.
I thought that as well a little bit, but maybe it's just us because it's J.K. Rowling.
Okay, so we've talked around a lot of issues there. Phil, I'm going to come straight to the point. Do you think J.K. Rowling should keep writing for adults?
Absolutely. And, you know, we talk about, although I wasn't as enthusiastic as you guys about it, I think it's a really flawed book, but there's some passages in it which are great, you know, and really have an emotional impact.
Yeah.
We talked about, you know, there's a rape scene, there's a domestic abuse scene, I suppose you'd call it, and the ending in particular. This is not a masterpiece or even a great book, but I think she could easily... if she'd written a book just about Crystal Whedon and her life and all the things in it, then it would have. Then I would have read that, you know, with some of these characters maybe drifting into her life. She writes her so well, you know, and her inner life. And some of the other more cardboard characters, kind of Midsummer Murders type kind of people, you know, really had no impact on me apart from being irritating. So I think she should... Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Do you think in that way, just thinking about what you're saying, do you think in that way it's a bit too personal, and that's the reason why, like, as in all of these issues are in there and all these characters are in there because it is quite personal to her. Like we've been saying, it's all her, this is how I feel about the nation, and perhaps, you know, as I felt with some of the later Harry Potter books, perhaps if an editor had come in, you know, and sort of said, let's fine-tune that.
I always feel uncomfortable saying this because my copy at the Herald is edited every day and it makes it much better, but and also you don't know how books are put together.
That's true.
You know, I don't know how this book was put together, but yes, I definitely think maybe a stronger editorial hand, maybe if she'd spent a bit more time on it, I don't know how much time, but it just feels like if it could have marinated a bit more and some things have been finessed a little bit more. That's a very subjective thing.
So, Claire, being a J.K. Rowling book, there must surely be some people in Hollywood talking about the possibility of making it into a movie because it's J.K. Rowling and her previous books have been made into films. Maybe that's just speculative, but would you watch that movie?
I don't know, because none of the Harry Potter movies were as anywhere near as good as the books. I feel like if it was made into a film, it would probably be a bit farcical in places.
Yes.
And not the messages, the political messages wouldn't have got through.
It would be a strange film. It would be kind of Mike Leigh in some of it, and it would be Four Weddings and a Funeral in other parts of it. It would be, you know, in this picturesque town in the West Country, so you'd have all that kind of lovely Englishness kind of thing going on. You know, it's definitely very... It feels very English to me. Obviously, she lives in Scotland. She lives in this city.
Well, maybe it's just Britain, and you know, if she made it about a Welsh or Scottish or Northern Irish village, then it would be more politicised, like regionally politicised, than it is if it was England. Not because England is more British than anywhere else.
I think these middle class values that she disapproves of are found in the middle class.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
In the UK. So it's obviously her choice, but you know, if it had been set in a imaginary middle class Scottish town.
Yeah.
I wonder why she didn't do that.
Well, maybe she was going for that old piece of advice of writing about what you know, and it's maybe just all about her. Where she's from. And I'd love to know if any of the people who she's based the characters on have recognised themselves.
She said in an interview that no one in the book is fully based on a real person, but there's that fully there, which means well, I guess it sounds like that we will all look forward to whatever she does next. Those are our thoughts on The Casual Vacancy by J.K. Rowling, and we'd love to hear what your take on the book is. So please get in touch with us via Facebook and Twitter. Just search Scottish BK Trust, or one word, and you'll find us. You can also email us at booktalk@scottishbooktrust.com. We look forward to your comments. And that's almost all from Book Talk this month. But before we go, I want to say thanks to my guests. Phil Miller, if people like what they've heard from you, where can they get more?
In the daily copy of the Herald, that of course they already buy, heraldscotland.com as well, and my blog on there, which is called State of the Arts.
All right, well, thanks for coming. It's been great to have you on here. And Claire Stewart, your Scottish Book Trust's Reader Development Coordinator, and you're currently busy coordinating Book Week Scotland. So tell us one thing the Book Talk listeners can look forward to there.
Well, on the Saturday, the 1st of December, which is the second last day of Book Week Scotland, there's going to be a fabulous all-day event in the Mitchell Library. Have a look at the Scottish Book Trust website. Go to bookweekscotland.com to find out more details.
Excellent. Well, look out for the next edition of the new Bookmarked podcast in early December, which will feature a ton of Book Week Scotland coverage and the announcement of the next Book Talk title. For Scottish Book Trust, I'm Paul Gallagher. Goodbye. Book Talk is produced by Colin Fraser, music by Sam Gallagher.